This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, we'll take a look at a couple of food and drink events on the Central Coast this summer. We'll start with Summer House, Edible San Luis Obispo Magazine's culinary celebration.
Everything from chef-inspired meals, chefs talking about the way they prepare food, farmers coming in to talk about their crops and the work they do, a little bit of everything.
Also, we'll talk to some of the organizers of the Central Coast Cider Festival.
What I'm really excited about this year is that we are moving it to the Sunken Gardens. And historically, it was always at the Lake Pavilion.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 22nd, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a look at Cal Poly's Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship.
Cal Poly Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship is situated in the heart of downtown San Luis Obispo on Higuera Street. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join Associate Professor Thomas Katona to discover the inside story about the under-the-radar incubator and accelerator center that offers both students and alumni with hands-on mentorship, weekly workshops, guest speakers, and much more. Thomas Katona.
You're from the Biomedical Engineering Department?
Yeah, I actually have a joint appointment between our College of Engineering and Orfila College of Business.
What's your position here at the Innovation Center, and how did you come to be here?
So I'm the current academic director for the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And so the center is supported and run out of California Polytechnic State University. It's really a partnership between the university, the city, the county, our alumni. And so we work on regional economic development, work with student innovators and entrepreneurs. So my role really is connecting everything that's going on at our center with the academic mission of the university.
Would it be fair to call it an incubator, a little nest for startup people?
We actually run a two-year incubator program out of this space. So that's one of multiple programs that are supported by the CIE.
And let's go back in time, kind of a philosophical lens looking at this organization. How did it come about and why? You know, who thought this was a good idea for a university to be engaged this way?
Yeah, so back in 2010, Jonathan York and Lou Tornatsky co-founded the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. It really was a strategic decision to take advantage of all of the innovation that was happening at the university and look for some means to both energize the campus and culture, but also find ways to help provide opportunities for those innovators if they want to try to take and get those innovations out into the market.
So on one level, it's say students, undergrad or grads that are in their little labs coming up with a cool idea and they need support and infrastructure. Would it also follow, let's say I lived in town or lived in Rio Grande and I'm a little nerd that's working on a project, but I need help. Could I come here too?
Yeah, one of the things that they did early on was make a decision to not just be a part of the campus. So we, you know, got a space that was out in the community, combined both the campus-related efforts with community efforts. And if you look at university entrepreneurship centers, really the two things that we did that are different than most of the centers is on the campus side, being an all-university-based center as opposed to only grounded in the College of Business. So anybody on campus can participate.
But so you have people from aeronautics or bioengineering.
Graphic design, psychology, ag engineering, you name it, they're coming in. So that's different than a lot of university entrepreneurship centers.
In what way does it differ?
Many of them are largely just in the College of Business.
Oh, interesting.
And then the other distinct thing was, as you mentioned, the community presence. So we have active co-working space for community members. We have a two-year incubator program for community members. And we run our small business development center out of this space, which is open to all community members.
How does the model pay-to-play work for somebody from the community? Do they have to pay a fee, a monthly?
Yeah, it depends on the program. So the Small Business Development Center is federally supported. So that's open to anybody to apply at no cost. The incubator program is a two-year program that has a fee that changes over the 2 years. And really, that program is intended for people who are working on businesses that are scaling, likely going to need external capital. And so there's more support for that to try to help people achieve the milestones that would get them to the point where they can raise capital, grow their business. And then the community co-working is open to all sorts of people who use this as a remote workspace, a place where even some of the people have home offices and they like to be around other folks working throughout the week. And so they pay a monthly membership fee. Mm-hmm.
But it's not a prohibitive fee. It's very accessible.
Yeah, it's very, very accessible. Yeah, it's not prohibitive. And we even have people that will come in and just rent day space in addition to that.
Is there any infrastructure support for them? Somebody to type stuff up? Or?
No one to type stuff up, but I think, you know, one of the things that we found from people is a lot of the support is being around others that are in these related programs. So you meet other people that you get connected with, you network with, you know, that's something that working out of your dining room, you don't get.
Right.
And we've even seen the fact that we've mixed the student programs and the community programs together. You know, we have companies that students are working on something, it doesn't work out, they end up hiring the students because they see how hardworking and smart they are. We've had students who have ended up hiring community workers because their business is growing.
You have these people from the community co-workspace, whatever, hanging out here to be socialized a little bit. Do you guys ever do meetups? Get together and kind of random brainstorm sessions?
Yeah, we have different things that happen in here throughout the year that we have sometimes just co-working meetups or social events.
But they're random, might not be thematic thread.
No, yeah. We actually, just last week we had a hot wings challenge. and yeah, it was just, you know, a way to get people together and laugh and kind of spend some time together outside of staring into a screen or being on a Zoom call. So,
do you ever have kind of random epiphanous moments that happen here because of that social network?
I can't think of one right at this time. I mean, I know that being part of a working community is really a big reason why people come in here. Following up on one of your other questions, which I didn't address, you said, you know, help with typing, and that's right. That's not really not one of our things. But yeah. I will say that through the Small Business Development Program, the companies that apply and get into that program have access to free consulting services from a variety of professionals, you know, span the range of supply chain help to helping with marketing and go-to-market plans. So there is assistance that's provided through the SBDC members through that.
That's really cool. So there really is a greater good dynamic.
Yeah, and we have a large network of consultants. I think one of the things that we see that's, you know, unique about San Luis Obispo is for a small town, we have a fairly large number of experienced professional folks.
A little random again, but I'm curious about you, your life journey. You know, where did you go to school? What did you think you were going to do, and how did you wind up here?
I mean, if you go back in time, I thought I was going to be a professional baseball player, and that was kind of a joke. But yeah, I don't know. I did my undergrad degree down in Santa Barbara, studied physics at Westmont College, worked for a few years in the aerospace industry after that, and then went back to grad school at UC Santa Barbara.
For what purpose?
Electrical engineering. And my field of study was really optical-based semiconductors. So as I was wrapping that up, my wife and I moved out to South Carolina to a small startup company that was spinning out of a university there that was directly related to the work that I had done in my PhD. And that was kind of my first entree into the startup world. Mm-hmm. And so we were out there for a number of years building and growing that company. Ended up coming back to the Central Coast because my grad school advisor was actually starting a company and called me up and asked if I wanted to help out with that. So that's what brought us back here.
And then somehow you wound up at the university. How did that happen?
Yeah, a couple more startups after that. But yeah, it was really late one night. I was online and saw this unique job posting that was very different than other academic positions. That was, you know, joint across two colleges, working with student entrepreneurs, working on product design. And it really did just kind of fit with what I had been doing in my career. And I was interested in spending more of my time kind of working with people and developing people.
Do you work mostly with graduate level students?
You know, almost all undergrad.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So Cal Poly's 80%+ undergrad. And yeah, the majority of my time is spent with the undergraduate students.
And you have regular formal classes or?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. Multiple days a week and multiple times a day. So yeah, a number of different courses across both engineering and business.
Okay. Segue. How did you wind up coming here and this being an adjunct part of your professorial duties?
It was always the intention that the role would be intimately connected with the CIE. And, you know, at the time that I was hired, what was happening is the entrepreneurship program, you know, under John York had been growing at the university. And there were a lot of engineering students participating, but there was nobody formally in the College of Engineering that was kind of there to connect those students to the programs. And so that was really the intention of the job, was bring those two colleges closer together, connect all of them together with the CIE, and make sure that we had a what looked like a cohesive effort.
Mm-hmm. In some of your day-to-day duties here, what would you focus on?
I spend most of my time in the summer down here in the downtown space, and right now we're running a summer accelerator program. So we have 8 teams of students working for 12 weeks out of the hothouse trying to get a scalable business off the ground. So I'm here every day kind of both bringing in experts to provide programming to them. I work with them on setting goals, milestones, and kind of moving their businesses along.
So are these dreamers where they don't quite know what they're going to evolve into or create?
Yeah, I would say they have a mission that they're working on. They have a solution that they envision. In many cases, that solution changes over time as they learn more about the market and the customer. But they're working on some pretty big ideas.
That's really cool. Looking back, can you think of some successes that have been nurtured here that you're impressed with?
Yeah, definitely. You know, out of the CIE, some of the kind of success stories that we can point to are InPress Technology, which became Alydia Health, was developing a device to help treat postpartum hemorrhage during pregnancy. And that company has since been acquired. We have still in town Flume Technology, which has a device which straps on your residential water meter, gives you real-time data on water usage. Utilities are, you know, subsidizing that device at this point because they need a way to keep track of water usage. Insurance companies are looking at it. So it's a, you know, it's a great company. We have Passion Footwear, which has developed a line of women's shoes that transition from a high heel to a flat, and they're doing really well. So those are just among a few.
And again, how long has this been up and running here?
So the center was founded in 2010. We've been in this current space since the summer of 2015. So it's grown a few times. We had a couple different locations. Like all good entrepreneurs, we've kind of been launching small prototypes and learning from it and growing, you know, based on the learnings.
And there's some expansion coming up, right? Or
there is, yeah. Our next goal, we're moving a few blocks from here to 1144 Choro Street, which is, you know, been an empty building for a number of years.
So you're going to leave this space here?
We will be, yeah. The space we're moving to used to be Copeland's Sports.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then before that, I think it was Riley's.
So you're taking over that main structure?
Yeah, there's going to be a big revitalization that happens to that building over the next year and a half.
Oh, the empire grows. Why? You know, what spurred you to seek a larger space?
I think, you know, some of it's opportunistic, some of it's strategic. As part of this move, we're going to be combining our facilities with the downtown Cal Poly stores. It'll be a larger co-branded and combined footprint for Cal Poly right in the central corridor. And I think it's a great time for Cal Poly to be actively involved and engaged in the local economic development community. So we're a large employer in town and we're a visible part of the community. And so,
but in a way, you're invisible.
Currently up here, we're invisible. Yeah. But that's
going to change, right?
It will.
And how will you retool and make a presence known to people walking down the street and people locally? Is that part of the model?
Yeah, absolutely. Combining with the Cal Poly store obviously helps because it's a retail space that anybody walks in, you know, at all times. And so being co-located with it, people walk in, they're interested in Cal Poly, they'll see the space, you know, the door next door and say, what is that? It's the Center for Innovation Entrepreneurship.
We have like a graphic displays of highlighting what you guys do.
Yeah, there'll be plenty of signage out there. We won't be invisible by any means.
That's really cool. As you know, I was back at Virginia Tech and with a cohort there. Do you guys interact and talk communally in the university world around the country in the little incubators?
We do. There are several conferences throughout the year that, you know, we've been active participants in, and that's a great place to meet others, learn from others.
It's a real value for you going there.
Absolutely. There's no sense in not learning from what other people are doing and both the good and the mistakes we're making and trying to get better.
it's hard for me looking in from the outside, you know, just kind of poking at this amorphous object. You're here, you're downtown, you're a local university, and how that benefits the community specifically.
We've touched on a little bit. I mean, one of the areas that being downtown really is purposely the university making sure that they're a visible partner with the community. Mm-hmm. So another thing that's been happening over the last 4 or 5 years is the regional economic development has been centralized under an organization called REACH, which spans from everywhere from down to Vandenberg up to just south of Monterey. As part of the new space downtown, there's going to be more intentional efforts for us to be connected with that organization. We've definitely been working with them in the past, but this really provides an opportunity for us to have a tighter connection, more cohesive economic development strategy.
That's really cool. In my mind, there's got to be some, like, oh my God, things that have come out of here that we haven't talked about. Is there another one you can think of?
Yeah, definitely. So two more, I mean, that are really fantastic. One is a very recent company that's spun out of our program from last summer, actually, and they're doing radar-based battery detection in the waste stream. What they found is, and that project started in a classroom in a senior project on campus, and, you know, what they learned was lots of people are using more and more batteries, and they just throw them in the trash. They end up causing massive fires back at the waste handling facilities. So they're able, with their technology, they strap onto a garbage truck, scan your trash bin, and they can tell the driver if there's a battery in there or not, and we know whether to take the trash or not, because battery is toxic waste. So they're already running pilots with two of the largest waste hauling companies in the U.S., and so that's an exciting one. Another one back from really the first year I started here, still a local company called Mantis Composites, and I hesitate to try to explain to you exactly what they do, but they're developing some deep, deep, hardcore materials, science, technology that's being used by the aerospace industry, and most people would never have heard of them. You don't see them, but a lot of times these companies in the aerospace, you know, defense industries, you don't see them, but they're out there doing stuff.
Do you ever partner with aerospace organizations down in Santa Maria, Vandenberg area?
Yeah, as part of the kind of the work that REACH is doing, and then Karen Tillman, who's the interim executive director for the CIE, and she works directly in the president's office up at Cal Poly, kind of running his economic development strategy. She's pulling together those pieces, and, you know, I think her being here is another definite intentional effort to more tightly connect the work that has been done over the last, you know, 10, 12 years at the CIE with the local economic development, with now the university's enhanced kind of presence in the economic development space.
That's so cool. And again, this is primarily undergraduates.
It is, and I think it's interesting. One thing that people should be aware of, and if they're, you know, get excited by the CIE, you know, on the student side, the companies are always fun to talk about. You know, that's great. We have a lot of fun when we see the success companies, but there's a whole host of students that we work with throughout the year, the vast majority that never start a company right out of college, because, you know, honestly, the odds are stacked against you when you start a company as a 22-year-old. Most entrepreneurs are a little bit older in life. But what we do see is you get calls every year from students who have gone through all of our other programs that are on campus. They take our classes. We have extracurricular programming throughout the year. And they'll call 4, 5, 6 years later and say, you know, I'm starting my company now. You know, I could use help. And I'm starting it because of what I did when I was at Cal Poly. So there's a whole host of things we haven't talked about on the educational side, extracurricular side, that impact close to 1,000 students a year that don't come into this building and start a company right away. But it changes who they are, and it changes kind of their career trajectory after their life here.
So when they come back and they reengage, is a lot of it remote and virtual? They don't physically come here?
It varies. You know, some of them are set up in life somewhere else, and they're starting their company there. We've had folks who have moved back to the area because they saw this as a great environment to start a company. It really does vary.
And do you have your garage and your little lab at home where you work on projects on the side?
I have some tools in my garage.
The dreamer at work.
I just want to thank you for taking time out and finding our little slice of the community interesting enough to come in and talk about. And it has been a lot of work over since 2010, slowly building, and kind of pulling all the different pieces and threads together, both on the campus and in the community. And we're really excited about this next move over to the new building.
To learn more about your world here, where would you direct us?
Go to the website cie.calpoly.edu. That's where we kind of have most of our information on the programs we offer. I'm Thomas Katona. I go by Tom, associate professor in the College of Engineering up at Cal Poly and academic director for the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship.
Awesome, Tom. Thanks for sharing. This has been a great morning.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, we have a couple of exciting local food and drink events coming up. Summer House, Edible San Luis Obispo Magazine's culinary celebration next week, and the Central Coast Cider Festival in late August. Let's start with Edible San Luis Obispo Magazine's food and drink event. It's July 28th through the 31st at the beautiful La Lomita Ranch. Proceeds benefit the Family Care Network. Father Ian Dellinger from Playing with Food brought together the organizers, some participants and beneficiaries in person and on Zoom.
Who do we have in the room? I'm Father Ian, and I'm with KCBX Public Radio.
I'm Jennifer Detriglode. I am a tea sommelier and Shada practitioner with NRET and art experiences.
I'm Lupita Ducharme, and I'm the Community Resource Development Supervisor at Family Care Network.
And I'm Jeff Carlson. I'm the CEO at Family Care Network.
And I'm Steve Bland. I'm one of the owners of Slow Provisions.
Hi, I'm Asia Gore, and I'm the managing editor of Edible San Luis Obispo Magazine.
Edible Slow is doing this event. Can you tell us about this event?
Yeah, so our event is the Edible Magazine Summer House. This is the second time we're producing this event. The first time we hosted it was about 5 years ago, right before the pandemic. So obviously a lot has changed since then. It's really just a gathering of people who love food, drink, agriculture, farming, and the passion that comes with writing and photographing those kinds of things. We're all coming together for several days of events tailored to those areas of focus. So everything from chef-inspired meals, chefs talking about the way they prepare food, farmers coming in to talk about their crops and the work they do, a little bit of everything, a taste of everything, if you will. So a lot of time and resources and energy goes into this. But it's something that we love to put on because it's a really great networking event and a really great way to meet the people that are responsible for making our plates so beautiful and our drinks so tasty.
Well, it sounds like an industry event. It sounds like a spectacular industry event. So what does it have to do with the Family Care Network?
I would say that it's not just an industry event because it's really something for the entire community. We even have an ice cream social so kids can come and enjoy too. The reason that we are partnering with the Family Care Network here is Gail, and of course Gail is our publisher, attended one of the fundraiser events at the beautiful Cass Winery a while back, thanks to an invitation from Lupita. And Gail was really blown away at the scope of the work that the organization does on the Central Coast, helping families, no matter what their situation is. And at the magazine, we really prioritize family. A lot of our contributors, whether they're writers, photographers, editors, all have families. So every time we have an event, we make sure to have a childcare section of our event so that the parents who are contributors can enjoy without concerns about what their kids are up to. And so we make sure that they're safe and taken care of. And they even have, you know, sometimes little kid charcuterie boards. So we really love this idea that the Family Care Network makes sure that families across the Central Coast have what they need to thrive. And that's something that we prioritize at the magazine as well.
Isn't a kid's charcuterie board just a Lunchable?
You know, it's a lot like a Lunchable, but I would say maybe a little bit more variety.
So Jeff and Lupita, what does this mean to you and how this partnership came to be?
For us, it's been really special. What a treat to be invited, but also having Edible support has meant so much to us, has helped us spread the word about Family Care Network, also showing how businesses are getting involved in supporting the nonprofit work. The proceeds that will come from this will go directly back to serving the kids and families that we serve.
We have two foodies who are participating in this. Is your involvement a contribution?
Yes. So I will be doing an experience, a chocolate and tea experience with Greta, which is a chocolatier. Her chocolatier space is out of Mistura restaurant. So her and I are going to be doing a chocolate and tea pairing. And so our experience, people buy tickets to come and enjoy that experience. And all of that will be going back to Family Care Network. So actually, tea is one of the best beverages to pair with food or chocolate or anything because it's not as strong as like wine or beer per se. So the nuances of the flavors in there, it's so varied with different teas. It just creates like this very beautiful combination. And Bretta's chocolates are amazing. It'll be a really fun like unique flavor experience in your mouth. And it's also great because, you know, there's more and more kind of like sober curious people moving towards a more sober lifestyle. So that's a great experience for them to have an experience like this with tasting food with a beverage that's not going to make you regret your choices the next day. So I'm really excited. It's actually something I wanted to do. It was kind of on my radar to do something like this year. And right kind of at the beginning of the year, Edible Slow, Gail reached out to me to do this. So I was really excited to take part.
Tea is essentially a fruit or an herb steeped in hot water. Does that make it kind of easier to pair because you've got like a dark chocolate and you've got like a raspberry tea?
So the teas that I work with are not actually herbal teas. Okay. They're true teas from the Camellia sinensis plant. And depending on the processing and when you pick it and all that, it can get you 6 very different manifestations of the tea, from white to green to black to pour. But those do definitely come with their own like aftertastes and nuances. So some of them are a little bit more floral and some of them are more fruity and some are more vegetative, and they will be paired with the chocolates kind of accordingly to what kind of compares and contrasts and brings out the unique flavors of the chocolate and the tea.
Edible reached out to us, Slow Provisions, to be one of the food purveyors at the ice cream social event on Sunday the 28th. The request was for us to do 2 bites that people could have, trying to keep one a vegetarian bite. And so we're doing a pork belly rillette and a carrot rillette as the vegetarian one. Those will be served on Christini. I think there are about 7 of us that are participating. I just noticed on the list, most of us are doing savory things. I think there's one person doing some pastry things too. I'll be over at the ice cream area.
And your staff will be passing out the
rillettes. I'll say bye. I'm off to the ice cream.
How did Edible Slow design the event? Did you design the event and then invite the people to participate, or did you find the people to participate and then design the event around that?
So it was a little bit of both. We had some ideas in mind from our last event like this, things that worked well and other areas that we felt we didn't get to touch on and wanted to elevate. One thing that has been really successful for us and has really been an enriching cultural opportunity was the Share My Kitchen series that we did with immigrant chefs. We're going to bring that back for this series of Edible Magazine Summer House. So a lot of this has really been reflecting on the last event that we had, and then also all the little events that we've had since then that we've done with people in the community, whether that's farmers, winemakers, or chefs, and just pulling them in. Because it really is a community, and Edible San Luis Obispo Magazine really is a community mouthpiece. We pride ourselves on being very connected with all of these different people in the industry. It's really a way to highlight and uplift the different members of our industry here. So a bit of both, pulling in people from last time, coming up with new ideas for this time, and then a little bit of the in-between events that we've had since then.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Father Ian is discovering how next week's Edible Slow Summer House Food and Drink event is bringing the community together to support Family Care Network. He's speaking with Asia Gore from Edible Slow, Lupita Ducharme and Jeff Carlson from Family Care Network, Jennifer DeChaglode from Inari Tea and Art, and Steve Bland from Slow Provisions.
For those participating, is the interest in helping the Family Care Network, is the interest in engaging with the community, or is the interest in showcasing your craft?
For me, it's all of the above. A great opportunity to kind of hit all those marks.
Yeah, same with us. When we heard that the Family Care Network was involved, that was definitely an incentive. But also the fact that it's at La Alameda is an incentive because that's a gorgeous place and we love to do things there.
Is that kind of true across all the people you ask, Asia?
Absolutely. You know, giving back to the community is something that our publisher, Gail, always puts at the forefront of everything that we do, considering that Immigrant Dinner Series, giving a mic, if you will, to someone who typically doesn't get the chance to share their culture and their culinary experience with the community. So that was a huge element of putting this event on and where those proceeds would go. But also, who doesn't love experiencing amazing food and drink and ice cream while also helping a great cause? So everyone that is involved really both wants to connect with the community and give back to the community in a big way.
And speaking of giving back, how present will Family Care Network be at these events throughout the week?
For Lupita and I, we are going to many of the events. I'm especially looking forward to the cookout. So I love barbecue and Wild Horse Wine and Harmony Creamery. I'm a big fan. So we are excited to be a part of that. Our goal is to just be there to be present and expose the people that are participating, whether it's the purveyors or the attendees, just about who we are as an organization and what we're doing in the community. We've been here for now almost 37 years and serving our children and family in the community. One thing I love about this area, the community is so collaborative, whether it's on the government level, on the restaurateur level, these partnerships are so invaluable because it exposes individuals to what we are doing, but it also allows them to join and partner with us in our mission to serve everyone in our community, especially children and families. So it's a great opportunity.
What does the Family Care Network do?
We serve primarily in four areas. So one, we do a lot of foster care services. So we have foster homes. We have a lot of what we consider more intensive service foster care, where the children have higher needs and the skills of those foster parents are at a higher level and providing a lot of mental health and support services to those families. We also do serve the homeless. So we have a housing support program that really allows us and our staff to find either transitional housing or permanent housing for families who are on the cusp of homelessness or experiencing homelessness. We also do a lot of in-home mental health services. So those services are primarily children and families who are generally at risk for being removed from their home, but we're going in and preventing those children from being removed and allowing that family unit to stay intact through our mental health services that we provide as well. And I would say lastly, we have a transitional age youth program. So we have about 45 transitional age youth that are currently in housing that we provide them. And we give them kind of resources and allow them to kind of go from our age range is usually from, so I say 16, 18, up to like 25. And it really provides them a stable environment to either go to school, learn a trade, get settled, get a job, and then be able to be launched and be on their own as a parent of young adults. And it's a very tentative transition from that 18 to 25 to really truly launch and be independent.
How many families and children are in your network at any point in time?
I would say last year we serve about 1,700 children and families on an annual basis is about the approximate number.
That's quite a bit. And is it just in the county or is it in the region?
We primarily are serving San Luis Obispo County. We have some in North Santa Barbara County down in Santa Maria and Orchid area.
So if you go from Orchid to San Miguel, mm-hmm. that's about 375,000 people. So 1,700 seems kind of, is that a high percentage?
Our referrals come from either the Department of Mental Health or the Department of Social Services. So it's really the clients we're serving are referred to us for the most part from those entities. Mm-hmm. And so it's really either they're going to receive services from us or they may be receiving services from the county or another county provider who's like mm-hmm. us, a CBO, community-based organization that's providing the similar mm-hmm. services.
Well, it's just trying to get a gauge of how prevalent is the need. Is the need greater than the general public would assume?
Yes, I think the one thing that people need to realize is Family Care Network really specializes in working with the highest need. The county could have a foster home placement where the child is stable and they're doing fine, but then maybe they have a child who needs a lot more mental health support. That kid would potentially come to us in our care. So I think that's how you can kind of differentiate some of those programs where we specialize in those high needs where maybe someone else does not.
And we are providing a service that is like a piece of the continuum of services. You know, so there's multiple organizations that are providing services throughout a child's like lifespan that are maybe early intervention things. We are serving, especially in our mental health in-home services. It's really a high need. And the child could be in with their biological family. The child could be in a foster family or a relative caregiver family where the child is now being referred to more intensive services to stabilize that current living situation with that child. So it is a piece of the continuum of care.
Okay. To the two of you and Asia, will you get a platform at any of these events?
Yes, that is what we've been told, and we're excited about it.
Yeah, in addition to that, we're going to have donation cards set out for other opportunities to donate at our event. So we'll make sure that that is a front and center piece there to be able to support the Family Care Network in any way that people can.
For the two other of you who work in food, what has your experience been with the Family Care Network?
My sister adopted a little girl, not so little anymore, but she adopted a little girl from social services. So I definitely know they got some support from Family Care Network. They've many, many times have run in the run that you guys used to have.
Miracle Mile for Kids.
So they were pretty good at supporting that. And I'm local. I was born and raised here. Actually, Lupita and I went to high school together. I've had numerous friends also who have worked at Family Care Networks.
Yeah, I think in such a small town, we're very well aware of what's going on and what, again, not personally affected or related, but we know what good work the organization does, and we see it every day in our community.
So this sounds like a wonderful event. How easy is that to manage, Asia?
It definitely takes a big team of people who have been involved in our events for many years. So everybody is well-versed on putting these events together, but it's a long list of people putting a hand in to make sure that this goes off without a hitch. Gail is a very key part of all of this with all of her connections she's developed over the years, making sure that we have each tiny detail in place. And you'll see that when you're at the event, that every little thing has been thought of. So it's definitely a lot of work. And after the last one, we were all very exhausted for many months, but it's been enough time since then that we've kind of forgotten about the hard stuff. And we're just excited to get together again and have a great big food fest.
Each of you, what are you most looking forward to in the event?
There was one part I didn't tell you about, is that aside from the chocolate and tea experience, I will be setting up my pop-up tea lounge, which is basically like a bell tent. And it's kind of meant to be a place where you can come and very slightly reminiscent of like tea houses in Taiwan or China, and just come and experience tea. I'll be serving tea Gong Fu style, which is a brewing technique out of China. So I'm excited to connect with people there, and people can buy tickets through the Edible Slow Summer House website. There's different times that you can come and do like a 20-minute session. So I'm excited to connect with people there. I'm excited for the chocolate and tea experience because it's just super unique and the flavors are so good. I'm so excited to share those combinations with people. And then of course, I will also be with my family at the ice cream social too. So excited for that as well.
I think it's too much. I'm excited for all of it. Ever since Gail mentioned it, I've been super excited. Obviously being able to represent Family Care Network is really exciting, and being able to talk with guests, but the food and being able to bring my family as well is gonna be great.
I think for me too, I'm a huge foodie, so I love cooking, I love eating. So to be a part of the event just for that is great. I think it's a bonus that we get to be and use this as a platform to kind of showcase what we do in the community and the impact we have. And I'm super excited about that opportunity. So.
We enjoy engaging with the community and with the people that attend these events. Sometimes they're people who, believe it or not, might have never heard of our business.
So yeah, you're everywhere.
So it's exciting to meet those people and get new connections in the community.
You know, it's difficult to choose just one because we have so many small events going on, from cooking classes to farm shares, chef's tables, the pairings you heard about, a lunch for farmers. So many things, but I am personally very excited about the editor's dinner that I'm hosting on July 29th, partnering with Chef Rachel Ponce for North County and her restaurant Front Room. So that'll be a very veggie forward dinner where we get to just sit and talk one-on-one with readers and supporters and subjects of the magazine. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
Well, thank you everyone for this. I hope it's a wonderful event. So we'll all be at the Ice Cream Social and we'll meet there again.
You can find out more about the events of the week and purchase tickets to the events of your choice at ediblesanluisobispo.com/summerhouse. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. The 6th annual Central Coast Cider Festival is August 24th, downtown Atascadero. Here to talk about it are my guests Maggie Probilski, co-owner of Two Broad Cider in San Luis Obispo, Cody Broadstone, owner of The Poisoned Apple in Atascadero, a cider bar, and Joey Radel, wine and cider maker at Kelsey C. Canyon. Welcome, and thank you all for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
Before we start getting into the upcoming Cider Festival, that's exciting. I just want to know briefly, what got each of you into cider making, or Cody, in your case, owning a cider bar? Let's start with you, Maggie.
I got into cider because my wife and I were making beer. And eventually along the way, once you have all the equipment you have to make beer, you can make wine and cider and mead. So it seemed like a natural progression, since we have some of those older orchards in the area, that we would go during the season and pick up jugs from Gopher Glen and just make cider. And then one year we were like, let's do it three times during the fall, because we knew that at Gopher Glen, all of the apples were changing every time we went. So we would taste what the different apple blends were doing. And we decided that our favorite was the first season, the first part of the season.
Oh, which is probably in August or something.
Yeah, Gravenstein.
And then we'll go with you, Joey.
Yes, so I've been in the industry for 10 years. I started my career at Kelsey C. Canyon Vineyards. My wife is part of the Kelsey family, so I was fortunate enough to just graduate Cal Poly and go right into the winemaking business. And for Kelsey C. Canyon Vineyards, it's really unique to make wine and cider, because if you're not familiar with C. Canyon, there's a lot of apples grown there. You know, we got Gopher Glen, many others. But, you know, so we start co-fermenting Chardonnay and apples.
Co-fermenting together.
Together. So we take the Chardonnay juice and the apple juice, put them together in one blend, and then you create a wine that way. So those are our two most popular wines coming out of the winery. There's a Red Delicious as well. So it's an apple rosé, very popular summer wine. So that's what got us kind of started in the apple and cider making process. And then things took off from there. You know, we had one cider when I got there, and then I started making a bunch more ciders in 2020.
Okay. And how about you, Cody? The Poisoned Apple. That's a great name.
Yeah. Actually, my fiance, she's the one who came up with the Poisoned Apple. Originally, we were planning the Poisoned Apple way back in 2019. I was still managing Bristol Cider House at the time. And all the names that I was coming up with were terrible. And then she came up with the Poisoned Apple, and that was that. Yeah, I started because of Bristol's. You know, I couldn't really believe it at the time that something that looked that cool and had such cool products existed in Atascadero. It was really cool. They're like almost ahead of their time, I felt like. So drank there for a year, and then, you know, I had the pleasure of becoming the manager. You know, Neil Collins gave me the opportunity for 22-year-old me to take over there, which is was an incredible opportunity for me. And they, you know, they took a gamble on me, and it ended up working out, hopefully, you know, for both of us. Yeah, I managed there for a while and just fell in love, you know, with the product, and fell in love with the people who were involved. And the cider community is such a tight-knit community. You know, back then when I first started, I had no idea about any of the process. And Bristol's is unique in a way where they pick and crush a lot of their own apples, and they crush them right there at the tasting room too. So I got to experience all that with the cider makers, and it was really just a really great experience.
Neil Collins is a name I hear associated with the cider industry. Was he pretty much the start of the cider industry locally?
He's the OG. He likes to say that he was thirsty for cider, though he'd been making wine at like Tablas Creek and opened his own company in the 90s. And we have a Bristol's right here on the table right now, and it says 1994.
So thinking of it that way, cider has been made on the Central Coast for quite a while then.
I think we've always made like a fresh cider, as long as there have been orchards that were not planted to make alcohol. We did lose a lot of heirloom and cider variety apples when Prohibition came along. And at the same time, agriculture was also changing, so they were selecting for different apples that would produce more and survive the journey from the orchard to the grocery store. But fresh cider has always probably been made on the Central Coast since they started planting those first orchards over in Sea Canyon.
Let's talk about the Cider Festival, 6th annual Cider Festival. I think you took a few pandemic years off. Who organizes the Cider Festival?
Well, it was Neil again.
Neil Collins.
Neil and family. And then we did take those 3 years off, and we all wanted to bring it back. So I reached out to everybody, and I was like, come on, man, let's do this. And then we're back. So Central Coast Cider Association was formed in order to put on the event, and it is a nonprofit. And part of the mission is to put on the Cider Festival, which will help promote other cideries, not just in the area, but also all over California, because we're inviting folks from all over California to come, but also to kind of educate the public a little bit more about what cider is and how it's made so differently than beer, because I think one of the biggest misconceptions about cider is that it is beer. Oh. It's not made like beer. It is not beer.
Is it made more like wine?
Yes.
Yeah, so actually, according to the government, it is a fruit product, an agricultural product. So that's where you get your sugars from the apple himself, just no different than grapes. Mm-hmm. So in the government's eye, there's a new law that passed, but breweries couldn't even make cider. It's a whole different process. You get your sugars from different sources. And so in the eye of the government, it was essentially an apple wine.
Got it. So the Cider Festival, what are you guys excited about?
Well, I think what I'm really excited about this year is that we are moving it to the Sunken Gardens. Historically, it was always at the Lake Pavilion. And we really wanted to bring it to the Sunken Gardens. The Tascadero has done so many cool events down there, and I feel like a lot of people in the area associate some of the best events with the Sunken Gardens. And it also, I think it's important to, you know, bring it downtown. And so a lot of people, even from out of the area, can kind of experience before and after the festival what Tascadero has to offer. I'm really hoping that because of this this change and this move, we'll have so much more space. We can invite so many more people. And we've already invited more cideries, and that's what I'm really excited is to bring it downtown. And also, the Poisoned Apple's downtown, too, so I get to, you know, poach off the Cider Fest and, you know, get people in there.
And so, Joey, how about you? What are you most excited about this year?
Well, I'm most excited about is, to kind of piggyback off of Maggie's comment, is that there's a lot of misconception with cider, you know, how it's made, you know, kind of what part of the industry it's in. And I think it's its own niche industry, you know, part of the industry. And a lot of people kind of either tangled into wine or beer. But I'm most excited about is just educating people about the cider making process, why cider is different, and to just get more awareness for cider in general.
Maggie, how about you?
I really enjoy the industry events with other cider makers. It's a great time to like swap stories and vent. They're such a helpful community and they inspire me. We've tried ciders from so many different places, from so many different people, and I love to hear what other people are doing. So that's what I'm excited about.
Will there be opportunities for those of us who go to the Cider Festival to meet some of these industry people too, or to
Absolutely.
Talk to the cider makers?
Absolutely.
To ask our questions.
That's what's so great about this festival too, is that a lot of the people that are going to be pouring the cider for you are cider makers. They tend to be a smaller company, really passionate folk who like to talk to people about cider, of who are at all levels. And so a lot of the folks who are going to be handing you that cider over the table, they're going to be the cider makers or really, really involved in the business and be able to answer those really intimate cider questions, if you will.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. My guests today are Maggie Probilski, co-owner of Two Broad Cider in SLO, Cody Broadstone, owner of The Poisoned Apple in Atascadero. It's a cider bar. And Joey Radel, wine and cider maker at Kelsey C. Canyon. We're talking about the 6th annual Central Coast Cider Festival. It's August 24th, new location this year, downtown Atascadero. What kind of questions do you get from people?
I never mind a question. Even if it's like an early educational part of cider, I'm always happy to answer any of those questions.
You know, owning a cider tavern where there's multiple things on top, you get, you know, people. I mean, we still serve, mead and beer and seltzer and whatnot, but you have people come in, you know, we're obviously cider focused, and there's people who, you know, they understand what cider is and they think it's just maybe this super sweet sugary product, and it can be, but it can also be so much more, especially, you know, what, you know, Maggie and Joey are making. Even though they're two totally different styles, it's not this apple juice. Like, it becomes more than just that after fermentation, and after what they do, we get a chance to show them what it is and what it can be.
So you say your styles are different. Joey, how is your style different than, say, Maggie's style?
Yeah, so I would say since I got into the wine business as a winemaker, that was my sole focus and mindset. So when I got to the winery, they said, hey, we make cider as well. You know, so I, you know, my approach to it was all winemaking. And so I treated the juice no different than, say, a Chardonnay, a Viognier, a Sauv Blanc. I looked at it as this is a white wine juice. Let's make a nice, clean, crisp product out of it. No different than I would maybe a Chardonnay or Viognier. There's no right or wrong really when doing it. And that's what's so fun about it. And though with different styles and, you know, philosophies and processes that you used with the fruit, makes a completely different product, whether it's filtered, unfiltered. We like to say we take a winemaker's approach to it.
And are there characteristics that you are looking for?
I usually make my white wines, you know, on the clean, crisp side, and it doesn't really go through a secondary fermentation where malic acid converts to lactic. So it's going to be more austere, not as full-bodied. I do sterile filter it, so it seems to be very, you know, a little cleaner and leaner on the palate, a little more refreshing, but that's just kind of the approach I take.
And that's the wine and the cider?
Wine and cider, yeah.
Okay.
We are playing with so many different styles because, again, being inspired by other cider makers, we want to try everything. So we're doing the co-ferments. We're trying stuff like Ciderkin and Piquette, and just really quick, those are both a similar product in that you rehydrate what you've already pressed and you let it macerate for a while. You just let the water sit in and reabsorb, and then you press it off again. And so you're rinsing off the rest of the juice, and you're getting a little more tannin extraction and maybe some wild yeast character sometimes. But it's a lighter product, lower in ABV, and we tend to put a little bit more carbonation on it and then serve it chilled. So it's a lighter sessionable version of cider or wine. So Ciderkin, the lighter sessionable version of cider, and Piquette, the lighter, more sessionable version of wine.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. My guests today are Maggie Probilski, co-owner of Two Broad Cider in SLO, Cody Broadstone, owner of The Poisoned Apple in Atascadero. It's a cider bar. And Joey Radel, wine and cider maker at Kelsey C. Canyon. We're talking about the 6th annual Central Coast Cider Festival. It's August 24th, new location this year, downtown Atascadero. And what else is going on? I know cider's the main draw, but what else can we find?
We're also, you know, bringing in more food trucks because we expect to have more people this year. And we're doing this with Enfuego events, and it's been really cool to have Andres's guidance in a new location, a bigger location, to have more activities there because since we're going to have so many people. So we're not only bringing in, you know, more food, we're bringing in not only a DJ and a live band. We have other vendors there as well. We have a gentleman who does handmade leather goods, a candle maker. It makes it feel more like a festival.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously it's about the cider. It's about sipping as much as you'd like. But also it's cool to go around and see what these other local vendors have to offer.
Bear City Social. I'm really excited to have him there. We got Earth and Oven back again. Mm-hmm.
Super Fiesta.
Super Fiesta. So
yeah,
good.
They did great last year.
Yeah.
So we definitely invited them back. There'll be plenty of food to go around. It'll be delicious. It'll be great.
So it is August 24th. It's downtown Atascadero. Is the best place to buy tickets, is it just on the website?
Yeah, centralcoastciderfestival.com.
centralcoastciderfestival.com.
Yeah, you can get all your information there. And if you follow all of the Central Coast Cider page on Instagram, any of the cider makers or the cideries or the Poisoned Apple, Kelsey, Two Broads, we'll be posting it on our socials very soon. We have two different sets of tickets, a general admission and a VIP, which gets you in an hour early.
An hour.
Some other perks.
I think I saw a designated driver ticket, too.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's very important. We want everyone to be responsible and everyone to be safe. That's, everyone can have their fun, but being responsible around this stuff is obviously, you know, the most important. Tickets are obviously much cheaper. I think it's like $10.
Yeah.
So you can still come in, still get the food. You can still experience the other vendors that we're inviting. So, you know, it won't be boring for them either.
Final thoughts, everyone? Joey?
Well, one, I would like to thank everyone part of the Central Coast Cider Association for putting this together. You know, it takes a lot of people to get this event going. I also do want to give a shout out to Cody. You know, if you guys haven't been up to the Poisoned Apple in Atascadero, it is a great spot, and you can try multiple different types of cider. So if you aren't able to get out to these venues, which we encourage you to come out to Kelsey and Two Broads and Bristol's and all these, but not everyone has that time. So Cody has a very centralized location where you can try all these local ciders, see what you like, and then go on from there.
Hey, thank you. Likewise, I have to thank and shout out to all the cider makers, you know, Joey, Maggie. They're the ones, boots on the ground, making the product so that my business can even exist. And so the Cider Fest can even exist. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't even be here.
That's cool.
Wait, I have questions. Carol, what is something that surprises you about cider?
The lack of sweetness.
Mm.
It was a good surprise.
Awesome.
Yes. And the beautiful colors. Isn't that terrible to say?
Not at all.
That's a, hey.
Aesthetically, it's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
We drink with our eyes first. You know, you look at a nice glass of cider and you're like, oh man, that's delicious.
Exactly. Already. Especially when they're all lined up in little glasses.
Yeah.
Love the taster. Love the flight. Joey, what surprised you most about cider?
How different it can be. I think that's what surprised me, is that you can take a juice from one fruit and make all different kinds of styles of that product. So that's what intrigued me most.
Kind of to follow up what you guys were saying, like the lack of sweetness when I first tried cider, you know, 9 years ago now, how dry it could be. And like, it's just, you know, if people haven't experienced, you know, some craft cider, especially dry craft cider, they really are missing out. They really just don't know how different it is. So, you know, a lot of people will come in, they think it's going to be this sweet, overly sweet product, and you can make it that way. And there's nothing wrong with having that as well. But a lot of people don't want that sweetness, and they want something dry, crisp, really refreshing. And it's funny to watch people try their first sip of completely bone dry cider, and like, what? They don't. It's almost they're confused. Like, this tastes delicious. It's like, yes, you're exactly right. It does taste delicious.
Yeah. You too, Maggie. Okay, we're turning the question on you.
I think that what surprised me most about cider is, number one, that people only want to drink it in the summertime. And there's just like there's a wine or a beer for every occasion, every weather, every season, you can drink cider all year round. I'm surprised when people are like, yeah, I'm only going to bring in a cider during the summertime, when you can find flavors of cider that are suitable for all times of day and times of year.
Good stuff, Maggie.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
I'll give you a job.
Thanks for letting me be you.
You can be me anytime. Well, thank you all for coming in. I appreciate it. And my guest today, Maggie Probilski, co-owner of Two Broads Cider and Slow, Cody Broadstone, owner of the Poisoned Apple in Atascadero Cider Bar, and Joey Radel, wine and cider maker at Kelsey C. Canyon. We're talking about the 6th Annual Central Coast Cider Festival, August 24th. It's now downtown Atascadero, and you can get tickets at centralcoastciderfestival.com. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Thank
go
you.
Get your tickets.
Yeah, hey, it's a blast. Yeah, get those tickets. Let's go.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.